Are you recording?
Yep, we're recording.
Perfect. Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Thanks very much for joining us. It's about 1 on June 23rd, 2021. And this is the second negotiated rulemaking meeting related to IDWR's rules of procedure. Let's start off just by with introductions. Let's go around the room. Here at IDWR, Gary, do you want to start?
Garrick Baxter here for the Department of Water Resources.
Megan Jenkins, recording.
Shelly Keene, Water Allocation Bureau Chief.
Matt Weaver.
Peter Anderson, Hearing Officer Coordinator.
And I'm Sean Costello, one of the Deputy Attorneys General that represents the department. Let's go around the horn on the Zoom call. Start with you, Chris.
Oh, Chris, you're on mute still.
Sorry about that. Chris Meyer on behalf of Suez.
Paul Arrington with the Idaho Water Users Association.
EJ Bond, Idaho Groundwater Appropriators.
Rebecca Moon, JR Simplot Company.
This is Mike Lawrence on behalf of Suez.
Yep, Chair on behalf of Minidoka Irrigation District and AFRD2.
Kent. This is Dan Condren standing in for Sarah Klon on behalf of the City of Pocatello.
Welcome, Dan.
Hi, thanks.
James Cephalo with the Department of Water Resources.
This is Vic Conrad with the JR Simplot Company.
Sarah Heiger on behalf of the Surface Water Coalition.
Hi, this is John Murdoch with the Department of the Interior.
And I think Bryce, if we haven't heard from Bryce yet.
Yes, Bryce Harris on behalf of a number of ditch companies and irrigation districts in the valley. Treasure Valley.
All right. Thanks, Bryce. I think we got everybody off the board.
Okay, thanks all. Just want to start off by thanking everyone for participating today and also for participating in the written comment round that we completed last week, especially Chris Meyer and Mike Lawrence. We appreciate your time. You know, it can take a lot of time, and we try to do our best internally here, and it took us some time to get through it as well, but we appreciate the help and the insights. And hopefully you can see our work a little bit in the response document that we posted to the website. I will try to respond to every comment that was made at this point. We will do the same thing on the next round. So let's talk about the timeline on the next round first, and just on rulemaking procedure generally. We would propose, you know, we did hear from Chris, and he said that today was going to be a hard deadline to make as far as submitting written comments. So this meeting we would sort of envision as more of a high level again comment period. And then we would propose July 7th, 2021 as a deadline for written comments, the second round. It's 2 weeks from now. So hopefully that works for everyone, and that's what we would propose. Because our hard deadline at this point is July 30th, 2021, and that is the deadline for our submittal of a proposed rule and a proposed rulemaking notice to the Office of the Administrative Rules Coordinator. If we can make that deadline, that July 30th deadline, and publish the proposed rule on September 1st. And just because of some of the nuances of rulemaking with zero-based regulation and just the way the legislature is reviewing rules, or not these days. We really feel like we need to hit that July 30th deadline for publication on September 1st. Of course, that doesn't mean that's not going to end the process or the public comment process. We will have a 21-day comment period on the proposed rule, and so that will trigger on the publication date. So that deadline would be September 22nd, 2021. Obviously, I'll provide all this to you waiting. Just kind of wanted to walk through it up front. So if all goes according to plan, then the pending rule, the agency would adopt a pending rule, and that publication would occur in November 2021 for legislative review and during the session in 2022. So before we open it up, I just wanted to go through a couple of what we view as significant changes in the straw man 2.0 and the second version of the straw man. Again, we tried to address your comments. We tried to grapple with each one. But first, I think with the definitional section, we brought up presiding officer, we brought up hearing officer, we brought up exceptions. We wanted to maintain that, the term exceptions and the notion of the exceptions. So you'll notice that in the definitional section. Second, we tried to incorporate email filing in this strawman 2.0. The majority of you asked for it. Hopefully, what we've done can be a trigger or a jump off point for you folks to come in and provide some insight there. At this point, it's hypothetical, but the road we're going down is email filing. And I will say there will be one additional change from what we have. There will actually be another sort of form of filing. And that will be because IDWR is getting very close to going live on their online tool to allow water right applications to be submitted online for fees to be paid online. I think a lot of the adjudication as well will occur through that online tool as well. So as far as filing in this set of rules, in the procedural rules, we will add reference to that online tool and the ability that folks will have to use the online tool to apply for a water right. I think just a couple of areas that we would like further comment and some help on. There was a lot of discussion internally, and Chris and Mike offered some changes related to this distinction between informal and formal proceedings. So we would solicit some comment there today and in written comment, and as well how or whether to delineate further between contested cases that include opposition and those that don't. Again, Chris and Mike pointed out some important comments related to that issue. I think also you solicit commentary on ex parte communications and exhaustion. Those were sort of the issues that still stick out in my mind. So again, today's meeting, I think we view it as try to keep it high level if we can. I don't think we want to really devolve into legal argument at this stage. I think we would appreciate the written comments. And once we have that, we'll have the both hearing recordings, two sets of written comments, and we can really just sit down and draft that third straw man, which will become the proposed rule text. So at this point, I think it seemed to work okay last time. I think we'll just kick it off and we can maintain some decorum. We'll just, whoever's ready to go, you can start your comment period, and we'll just go through whoever wants to comment.
Sean, real quickly, I believe Marie Kellner showed up. We might want to get her on the roster.
Hi, Marie.
Hi, everyone. Sorry that I was late, and greetings from Cleveland, Tennessee. Southeastern Tennessee, right, where Zoom works just fine. I appreciate
it. Thanks, Marie.
Be here.
Okay, whoever's ready.
This is Chris Meyer. I'm holding off in case others would like to go first. I can go whenever you like. Well, I'm
our taker, Chris.
Okay, all right, I'll lead off. Well, let me begin by just observing how well this process is working, and I'd like to commend everybody at IDWR as well as all of the commenters for participating in what I view as a very effective collegial discussion. I mean, to me, this is what makes practicing in Idaho a lot of fun, because it's been respectful and thoughtful, and I appreciate the fact that the department went through so carefully on every one of these comments and prepared thoughtful responses. You know, for example, there were any number of ones that Mike Lawrence and I offered up as suggestions where the department went in a different direction and in some cases came up with a better solution than we had provided even. So, you know, even if it was a rejection of our suggestion, it just shows the benefit of this process. So I just wanted to begin on that high note and hopefully stay on that high note throughout the discussion today. I have a number of comments, but they're going to be kind of probably a little bit bouncing around. I didn't have a chance to get my head above water until yesterday evening on this. Let me begin by asking a kind of a technical question that may then feed into some of the other discussions. There's a new definition of presiding officer, which is helpful to have. But one thing that I'm not clear on is whether the department contemplates that the presiding officer comes into play only at the beginning of formal proceedings, or if there is also a presiding officer that would be the person that would conduct the informal proceedings. So maybe I can just bounce that question back before me continuing.
Well, Chris, this is Garrick. I think we contemplated that there might be a situation that we have a matter that we can identify right away is going to have to go to formal proceedings quickly, let's say a large delivery call or some other type of action. And then we promptly assign a presiding officer and move forward with that. But also, I think the run-of-the-mill day-to-day activities, like if somebody files a water right application out in Western Regional Office, I don't anticipate we will assign a presiding officer until after the opportunity for informal procedures to work through has completed. I don't know, Peter, did you see that differently or?
No. Chris, this is Peter Anderson. My take is that some of this will not actually be apparent when we get underway under these rules. It will be like what you're used to seeing, which is the application protest will be dealt with likely at a regional office level with perhaps the regional manager or a water rights supervisor conducting those settlement negotiations to try at an informal way to get the case resolved, which is often the great majority of these kind of protested matters get resolved in that way. The department does not use a presiding officer there as much as department employees to try and facilitate the settlement at that stage. There is a little bit of a complication because we see petitions to intervene at that time, and those will likely have to be dealt with by the regional manager, kind of like they're done now. Though, if it is apparent that it's quickly going to devolve into a fairly tough hearing, we could even assign a presiding officer and then to make a decision on a matter like that, and then it could be reassigned back for those informal proceedings. You know, so I think there's some ability to be sensitive and thoughtful about how that process would occur. But the bottom line is it will likely look a lot like what you're familiar with.
Well, that was helpful. The reason that I asked is the definition of presiding officer and the question of when the presiding officer is appointed may key in to some other provisions in the rules as well. The one that I have in mind is 414 dealing with ex parte communications. And that rule is shaped in terms of what a presiding officer can do. And so that kind of goes to my next question, which is, are the ex parte communication rules triggered only by the formal phase of the proceedings or not? To put it very directly, prior to the formal phase, if we are in, we just filed the application, nothing much has happened, or maybe we're in the informal discussion, is it permissible to have what would otherwise be ex parte communication with, even the agency head or, with the presiding officer? If the presiding officer is operating in an informal mode of just conducting an informal settlement conference, do ex parte communication rules apply or not? And I'll just offer that as a question rather than as one of advocacy for which way it ought to be.
I've asked Sean to go ahead and pull up the rule so everybody can see the ex parte communication language. All right, can everybody see that rule pulled up now?
Yes, I can.
Excellent, thank you, Marie. Sean, can you make that a little bit bigger, my eyes? One down, there we go, thank you. So, Chris, if I had to answer your question based upon the existing rule and the existing rule with the changes being proposed, the key is those conversations with the presiding officer. If we don't have a presiding officer during the informal process, if there's communications, amongst each other or whatnot, I don't see that they would violate the ex parte communication rule.
I'm entirely comfortable with that. I just want to make sure that we have a rule that everybody reads the same way and it doesn't require a lawyer to understand it. It seems to me there are two ways of approaching that. One is if that's what the rule is, and again, I'm comfortable with that. I think it's appropriate to have discussions with agency staff all the way up to the director before things really get started. But if that is the rule, I think there are two ways of, or if that's the intention, I think there are two ways that this might be clarified. One is to have something else in the rule that makes very clear when the presiding officer is appointed, because otherwise I might be sitting here wondering, well, is Gary Spackman the presiding officer now, or is the regional director the presiding officer? I don't know whether I can have an ex parte communication with them, because to me there's not a bright line. I'm not aware that there's an order that goes out and necessarily and says, okay, as of today, I am appointing a presiding officer and this is the person's name. The other way to do it would just be to actually change the language in the ex parte communication rule 414, formerly 417, and say it does not apply until you get to formal proceedings, if that makes sense. So I guess the first question is the substantive one. Does Does the department and do other parties think it's appropriate to have those kinds of discussions prior to the formal stage of the proceeding? And if we can reach consensus on what the substantive limitation is, then it's a question of how do you implement that most effectively so that somebody can read this rule and know the answer and at any stage in the proceeding know whether it's triggered or not.
No, you bring up a good point, Chris. I'll go back to the first kind of pathway you articulated about making it clear when a presiding officer is appointed. You're not the first person I've heard to raise that question in the past of clarifying, you know, when exactly does that occur? Is there some sort of order? Oftentimes we'll identify that individual in maybe a pre-hearing conference order, but I think you've given us food for thought here to think about some more on that front. On your other kind of idea that you've thrown out there, where you suggest that the other option is to say that it does not apply and get to formal proceedings, I personally kind of see pluses and minuses that way. It might have some impact on IDWR staff, just the amount of people reaching out to them and contacting them. I don't know. I'd have to ponder that one, I think, a bit more. But again, I think that's good food for thought.
Well, I would certainly welcome further discussion on it. Maybe there are others that are on the Zoom meeting today that either now or later want to weigh in on this. It is something that, you know, to me, I've never had a clear answer in my mind as to what to do. And so I tend to be pretty conservative and not have those discussions at all. But it would really be nice to have a bright line rule that we could follow.
Good comments there, Chris. Does anybody else have comments on this particular topic?
This is James Cephalo. I just have a thought. I think that this rule and the kind of the scenario that Chris has laid out has some interplay with the rule about disqualifying hearing officers. Now, our proposal is to simplify that disqualification rule, and really all it does is point people back to the provision of Idaho Code. So it's section 67, what is it? Section 67-5252. And really that just says that one of the reasons that somebody may be disqualified as a hearing officer is, what is the language here, substantial prior involvement in the matter. And so that would just be kind of my concern, is if somebody has had lengthy discussions about a proposed application or, I guess a possible contested case before it kind of arrives to the need of a presiding officer, then that person may not be able to act as a hearing officer for the department. So just a thought, I think there's a little bit of interplay there.
And just another thought, you know, maybe the way of dealing with that is to soften the disqualification requirement. I mean, there is some advantage to the ability to have collegial discussions with, you know, a regional manager, for example, about how to do a really complex new type of application. And then, you know, do you really want to say, oh, well, now since I've picked your brain on this, you can't be the hearing officer? That'd be unfortunate. It seems to me there are other remedies to that, such as very full disclosure of all those prior discussions and allow people to come in and, you know, make their case that, you know, the applicant really got us started on a wrong track and we need to get back. Well, those are just thoughts, I guess.
My one concern there, Chris, on the disqualification is that is statutory. So I don't know if we have a lot of flexibility to adjust that.
Fair concern.
I will say we'll take what you said, Chris, under consideration here today. I've been taking notes, and others have as well. And if you could provide, you know, this again in your written comments, that'll also help us ensure that we've pondered this a little bit more. So thank you, Chris, on that point.
Very good. It does also kind of tie in with the words that you added to the definition of a formal proceeding, which I thought was helpful. And in fact, you rejected what I suggested. I like what you did better, that you maintain this distinction. You said a formal proceeding is quasi-judicial. And I think that's a helpful distinction because it also ties in with the sort of common law rules of when ex parte communications kick in. And so I think that, not failing to acknowledge James Cephalo's observation about the disqualification rule, it does provide some further support for saying that there can be, brain teasing discussions with agency staff prior to the formal phase of the proceeding. But I think we probably beat this horse enough for today's meeting. Let's move on. One other item that Mike and I had suggested was eliminating recommended orders and proceeding just with preliminary orders, just in the spirit of simplifying the rules. And the agency said can't do that because it doesn't fit in with the timing of what the water board does. And I was just curious what that timing is. I guess I haven't done those proceedings and was wondering if there's any way that one could make the procedural order mechanism flexible enough to accommodate the water board. I still, this is not, a big deal issue, but it to me, it's just an area that would be consistent with what the governor is seeking to achieve, which is simpler rules. And it just, every time I have to relearn those rules of the difference between the two, it's like, well, that was how much time I wasted that day. So.
All right. No, honestly, I'd love nothing more in a perfect world to get rid of recommended orders, but they really are the key mechanism in which the board operates and hears matters. For example, if somebody was to challenge the denial of a dredge mine permit, that ultimately, can go to the board. Normally the board won't hear these type of matters themselves. They'll assign a hearing officer to hear the matter and then to make a recommended order to the board. And, if it was just a preliminary order, let's just say James Cephalo got appointed to be the hearing officer and it was a preliminary order, he'd go through the hearing, he'd issue a decision. But as you're likely aware, Chris, the board meets on about an every other month schedule. And so if James issues his decision and it's automatically issued as a preliminary order, it, goes final before, even the board has a time to meet and consider. They might want to change what he's done. They might disagree with it they might want to evaluate it in a public forum and then agree and support it and adopt it. There might be something in between there. But just given the timeframes for the meeting of the board, the most effective way they have found is to say, okay, we're going to assign a hearing officer to hear a matter, but we're going to require them to issue it as a recommended order. Then in that circumstance, James would go through the hearing, issue a recommended order, and then it stays put until the board takes some action on that specific order. And they found that to be the most effective way for them to be able to maintain that ability to consider what the hearing officer has done. So, and I haven't heard any desire on their part to change that process. So I think for that reason is why we left it in to this point in time.
Would it be statutorily permissible to modify the preliminary order rule to say, you know, in the case of the water board, the order, you know, the deadline for action, you know, is, I don't know, 4 months?
If I recall correctly, under the APA, you can delay the effectiveness of the order, but I don't know if you can declare, you know, modify when it becomes a final order. And so I think if it's under the APA, it's identified as a preliminary order, it by statute has specific triggering dates associated with it. That's my recollection as I sit here, which you work with me long enough, Chris, you know, sometimes my memory isn't perfect, but
a lot better than mine.
Because a lot of those deadlines are statutory, I don't think we can modify them as best as I can recall, but maybe I'm wrong on that.
Okay. Well, it sounds like we tried hard and that's just not going to work. Here's kind of randomly a more minor one on the protection of settlement offers. The thing that I was trying to communicate is my view that if someone makes a settlement offer in the context of a negotiation, that ought to be protected to protect the person making the offer. In other words, I should not find myself in a position where I say, well, I'll agree to do certain type of well monitoring if you'll withdraw your protest, and then the other side declines to agree to that, but then offers that to show how feasible it is to do that kind of well monitoring. That should not be allowed. On the other hand, I don't view it as something that ought to work, a privilege that ought to be held by the person receiving the offer. And if the person extending the offer decides unilaterally to share that offer with the presiding officer, wants to make it a part of the record, it seems to me that shouldn't be automatically precluded. There may be other reasons why the hearing officer wouldn't care to see that. It might be viewed as not relevant, for instance. But it might be, and it seems to me it shouldn't automatically be excluded just because it arose for the first time in the context of a settlement offer. And you know, sometimes I think it can be helpful for the presiding officer to know if that, you know, that something was offered it can be helpful in holding people's feet to the fire, but again, I view it as a one-way protection, not a two-way protection. And, you know, so the basic question is a substantive one. You know, is that correct that the person receiving the offer ought to be able to prevent the presiding officer from knowing that an offer was made to him or her? If so, then you have accurately described that in your rules.
So Chris, can you refresh my recollection? Which rule are you talking about here?
There are three places where that appears. But I need to pull out my notes on where that is. It's rule 515, rule 610, and rule 101.4. So you might just try 515 somewhat arbitrarily.
All right. Can everybody see the screen there? I'm assuming everybody can see the screen.
This is Marie, MCM Rule 515.
Thank you, Marie. And so, Chris, your comment here, just so I'm clear on it, is that the way we have the rule worded right now, the person who made the offer, who wants to make it a you know, part of the record that they made this offer, wouldn't be able to do that, is your interpretation of this rule, and you'd like to see it modified such that the person who makes an offer can unilaterally ask the hearing officer to consider that fact, that right. An offer has been.
Yes, uh-huh. And, you know, that might be for some substantive reason. It might, to be completely blunt, it might be for purposes of showing that, hey, my client is wearing the white hat here. So, I just want you to know, we tried to settle this. Or it might be for attorney fee purposes down the road. If it goes to, district court and ultimately, the decision was exactly what you'd offered 2 years ago, you might kind of like that to be in the record.
Okay. Well, I don't have a personal comment on that right immediately. Does anybody here in the room have any thoughts on that?
James had the most cogent argument regarding that, I thought. James,
do you have thoughts on that particular issue right now?
If I said something smart in the past, I can't remember what it was. I'd be interested to hear what some of the other attorneys on the call have to say. I know that the attorneys have represented both maybe applicants and protestants in the past, but I've kind of seen what Chris has described most often, where an applicant makes what they believe is a reasonable offer that was rejected, and they simply want that in the record, kind of the substance of what they've already been willing to give.
Anybody else on the phone have thoughts or comments on this issue? Well, given that I don't hear anything, I think, Chris, we'll take your comment under advisement and ponder it some more.
Thank you. Let's see. Here's a very minor point on service by email, and let me begin. I bet I speak for everybody in saying thank you for allowing us to move toward service by email, and as we learned today, service by online filing. So at this point, we're just down to the icing on the cake, because you gave us the cake, and the icing would be to have that kick in automatically, even for service on day one, rather than awaiting the presiding officer's order. It seems to me that you allow people to offer their email when they file a pleading, whether it's the application or a protest or what have you. And if they put an email on their filing, then you ought to be able to serve them by that email. If they don't have an email address or they don't want to rely on email, then don't supply an email. And they will have to be served by hard copy. But also they would not get the benefit of being able to serve others by email. I just don't see a reason to wait for the hearing officer or other presiding officer to think that through. It seems to me that ought to be automatic. And, frankly, it takes some time just to prepare the first certificate of service in a complicated proceeding. And why go through that, a couple of times while you're waiting for the hearing officer to issue the order? Again, minor point in the grand scheme of things. So I just toss it out there.
Sean, will you scroll down a little bit to the, thank you. Scroll up just a tad, there we go. So your comment, Chris, really goes to this sub two, sub B paragraph here, where you'd right. like to see this modified such that you don't have to wait to be authorized by the presiding officer to serve on other persons in the first instance.
I mean, it seems to me the only reason, the only person we need to protect is somebody who doesn't have an email or somebody who just says, I really don't want that. I don't trust my email. My dog always eats my iPhone and I don't want service that way. And fine, let's protect them. But if they offer an email, why not use it from the first day?
I would welcome, Chris, if you would propose specific language that you'd like to see on this one especially. I'd welcome your thoughts on that. It's always nice to have a target to evaluate when we're taking a look at this. So.
Okay. Is there anybody out there listening that thinks we need to be more cautious and that we really do need an order from the presiding officer, or is there consensus on this?
This is TJ. I'm on board 100%, Chris. I think email ought to be the default and standard mail ought to be the exception to the rule.
Thank you. I don't think we probably need to have this discussion now, but I'll just flag the question of declaratory rulings. We had offered a fairly detailed proposal on declaratory rulings. And the department said, we decline to do that, but we invite further discussion. I guess I'll ask you, I'm assuming that that's too much to bite off for this process and you'd like to do it for some other. If on the other hand, you want us to continue to explain our thinking on that, and there's actually some chance that it would be included in this round of rulemaking amendments, then that's something that needs to rise higher on my list of to-dos.
Looks like Sean's anticipating my next request of, can you find the declaratory ruling PC?
Yeah, and you, I don't know if you can easily throw it up, but maybe if you could show your comments, which show the stricken portion of my suggestions, or just mine. But yeah, that would work. Let me see what page that is, but.
So everybody can see the screen here. The blue will be Chris's proposed changes, if I'm remembering correctly.
Right.
And then you could scroll down to see what our response was. Okay.
So I really defer to you on whether you want to engage on this subject now. It's of great fascination to me, but I may be the only person in the state with that fascination.
Well, Chris, I'm trying to recreate in my mind and might rely on Sean and Peter and James to tag on the back end of this. But my recollection, our take on the declaratory ruling piece was that a lot of this is statutory, and we really don't need to have an in-depth analysis in these particular rules. I think we tweaked. Well, no, I won't even say that. So I think that was our goal, was to keep it fairly streamlined and just reference back to the statute. I'm trying to remember what we must have had some discussion and thought it was fascinating to put in our comment back to you. You know, we welcome additional discussion. I'm trying to recall what that was as I sit here. I don't know. I might need to go back and review some other notes to figure out why we
invited further discussion on that particular issue, but something that you said there must have caught our attention. Sean, Peter, or James, do you recall what that might have been? At least as we sit here.
Can we bring up the comment, his comments again?
I could highlight them if you want me to. Again, it's up to you whether you want me to, you know, step through this or if you want to just shut down the conversation.
That might be helpful, Chris, just to highlight as I'm reading it here that might trigger a memory.
Hey, Chris, this is Peter. I kind of remember a conversation in part. The question is, what problem are you trying to solve? Why do we need to change the rule as originally written, just provides for notice as determined by the director as necessary, but is there a problem you're addressing? Or
yes, Peter. And good question. Why do we need this? I think is your question, Peter. And the reason, to some extent, is personal because I went through a very expensive declaratory ruling matter for another client. It was not a water matter. It was unrelated to water, but it was very expensive. And every single one of these issues we litigated at enormous cost to the client, because they are completely unclear under the statute and completely unclear under any Idaho precedent. And it would be very nice for users of this system to know what the answers are. It would save an awful lot of money. To me, this is exactly what the governor ought to be wanting to have happen, not just can we shrink the number of pages of regulations, but can we actually have regulations that tell people how something works so that they don't have to spend 8 months litigating something and then have somebody say, oh, no, that's not how it works, which is what happened to me. Just one of these, for example, is it says the subsection B, declaratory ruling should be forward looking in their applicability and should not be employed to alter or circumvent prior agency orders on applications or petitions. And there's been a lot of litigation on this subject. Frankly, I was doing the very bad thing that this rule says you can't do. I was using it for a client whose prior lawyer had missed a deadline. And I was using a declaratory ruling as an effort to end run that decision and to get a second bite at the apple, if I may be so blunt about what I was doing, but it appeared to be permissible. Frankly, I don't care what the answer is, you know, can you use it for that purpose or not, but it would be very helpful to just say so that people can say, well, that doesn't look like it's an option, or, oh, that does look like it's an option. And frankly, the courts are mixed on this. It's almost entirely courts outside of Idaho. I think there's one ruling in Idaho. I think you have the flexibility to go either way on that. I put it this way because I think it's kind of fair, even though it's not what I was doing in that case. And it appears to reflect the majority rule throughout the United States. The other one under sub A is just this question of what is the mechanism for it? And frankly, I think the hearing officer got that a little bollocked up in our case. Ultimately, he ruled that the declaratory ruling was not a contested case, and therefore various other things happened. And it seems to me that it needs to be clear what the process is, that one, you know, first you file a petition for declaratory ruling, and at that point, the department can either entertain it or not. In other words, if
Aunt Mabel every morning gets up and files a petition for declaratory ruling saying, Gary Spackman, would you please have a ruling on whether I can shut down my neighbor's sprinklers? They're bothering me. The department ought to be able to say, we're not going to even entertain that application. We're not going to initiate a contested case. It is a non, we're returning your petition to you. That ought to be an option for the department, but it ought to be a two-step process. They ought to first say, are we going to entertain it? And if they are going to entertain it, then are they going to entertain it in that form, or are they going to reject the petition and instead establish a new contested case? Again, I went through this and it was very painful and costly for my client. And it would have been extremely helpful to have a rule like this. Would have saved a lot of money. I'll stop.
I think that's helpful background information, Chris. I think that's exactly what we were looking for. And that, when Peter started going down that path line, that jogged my memory. And it was, yeah, we were hoping for a little more explanation as to what the issue was that was trying to be addressed or fixed. So I think that gives us some good additional information to ponder here.
Okay, thank you. Chris, if you provide further written comments, it would be great if you could give us some citations and anything helpful to help us figure out what we want to do.
I sure will.
Thank you.
I think my last question is on exhaustion, and I think we're moving in a good direction on that. I guess my first question is the substantive one, and then the second one is if, you know, once we are clear on what the substantive rule is, I think there may be ways of articulating it in the rules to make them easier for the layperson to understand. And so the first question is the substantive one. Do I understand correctly that the department is saying it is not necessary to file either a motion for reconsideration or exceptions in order to exhaust one's administrative remedies, that those are optional and not required in order to seek judicial review. Is that correct?
So Chris, if we go back a little bit, and some of the folks here on the phone were involved in the case and might recall it, we had a case where the argument was made before Judge Wildman that, well, let me back up a little bit and just lay out the facts of the situation. My recollection that we had an order issued by a hearing officer here of the agency, and it got appealed directly from the hearing officer up to district court without seeking exceptions to the director first. And in that case, it's my recollection that the district court held that it is not required for somebody to file exceptions with the director before taking that case up to district court. So I think on the second issue, or the second phrasing of that, or the second issue there that you asked about, at least the case law from Judge Wildman, and it seems pretty consistent with the statute to me, says that yes, that somebody can appeal a final order of a hearing officer, or let me say a hearing officer's order that has gone, or preliminary order that has gone final, they can appeal that to district court without seeking exceptions. I don't think that case, though, answered the question specifically about whether or not they must seek reconsideration of the hearing officer's decision with the hearing officer before appealing that directly to district court. At least that's my recollection. It didn't answer that question. And I think that still might be an open question. And so I think, if I recall correctly, in our actions here on the rule, we adopted part of your proposal on the exhaustion piece about how it's not, how it is appropriate to go ahead and find, let me see, where are we at here, Sean? Let me.
You might want to go down to the.
There's 730.02 and then there's 740.02D.
Here shall be deemed to have exhausted. I think 730.02A is a good place to look on the new straw man.
So this is, are we looking at the new straw man or is this Chris's proposed change?
No, you got the right one, the new straw, yeah, this is the new straw man.
This is the response.
No, so this is Chris's, go to the straw man. So here we go. Yeah, under 02A, so we accepted your proposed change to say that filing exceptions of the agency head is not required in order to exhaust administrative remedies. We've accepted that piece, but we did not accept the piece that said that you do not need to file reconsideration with the hearing officer.
Right. And so maybe you've answered the question because, you know, I read that and it said, well, okay, I know the answer to one. How come you didn't answer the other question? And I guess you're saying, well, by intent, we didn't answer it because we don't know the answer. On the other hand, if you look at 440.02.D, that seems, as I read it, that seems to say you don't have to do either.
Sorry, what was the reference?
740.02. And then D. Now, maybe I'm misreading this, but it seems to say by the time you get to the final order, everything is exhausted. And that would mean that, you know, whether you filed a petition for, whether you sought reconsideration or not, exhaustion has been achieved.
When we looked at your proposed change here, because I'm thinking this was proposed changes recommended by you. I don't know if I put that, if I was drawing that same conclusion, but I think I'll take a look at that in light of the discussion here today. So that's
740.02D.
Chris, this is Peter. We're pretty cautious about saying what exhaustion is or isn't because the Idaho APA says that's a jurisdictional issue. And depending on what we do, we could send folks astray if we say you don't have to apply for reconsideration. So somebody doesn't, and then the court says you have to exhaust all of your administrative remedies, and since you did not file for reconsideration, I'm not even going to consider your appeal. We've sent somebody down the wrong path. Caution or conservatism would suggest we not step into the middle of that until we have a clear idea of what people have to do.
Yeah, I appreciate that concern, and it's a legitimate one that you can't run the risk of telling people everything's okay and then you didn't have the power to tell them that it's okay not to file for reconsideration. So that, I mean, that's the one side of it. The other side of it is, well, we haven't achieved our goal of answering questions and making this process less lawyerly. Instead, you know, every single time you have to hire a lawyer to research this, and it's not a simple question, and then to take a guess as to which is right, and that it completely falls short of the governor's goal of simplifying the administrative process. So, you know, it's I understand that punting on this is the safer thing to do, in that it eliminates the risk of answering the question wrong, but boy, it fails to accomplish the goal, which is disappointing. My inclination would be to just say what you think it is, and if it proves to be wrong, well, then I guess somebody will find out. But, you know,
Hopefully.
Yeah, but seriously, isn't it pretty darn clear? And maybe I'm wrong on this. I have not researched this to the hilt, but isn't it pretty clear that the agency has pretty broad authority to define what exhaustion is? I mean, I think, you know, the courts struggle with it when the agency fails to say whether it's optional or mandatory. You know, that's where the courts jump in. But if the agency says this is an optional procedure, just say those words. This is an optional procedure. I mean, what is the likelihood that a court would say, no, the agency cannot make that an optional procedure? I think the chance of that is slim. Moreover, these rules are going to be approved by the legislature. Doesn't that make them the law?
You know, Chris, I think that the...
John, could you bring up the Idaho APA and the exhaustion?
It's not helpful, but yes.
5271. While you're getting there, this is Mike Lawrence. I want to chime in support of Chris's comments on this subject. And particularly with the way that 730.02A has been worded, where it states that filing exceptions to the agency head is not required in order to exhaust administrative remedies. And I get that statement's there because of Judge Wildman's ruling. But doesn't that by implication mean that petitions for reconsideration or requests for hearing under 1701A3 are required to exhaust administrative remedies? I don't want to be put in that pickle of having to decide that. And I would rather have it clear that those are, you know, Chris used the term optional, but those other processes, the 1701A3 and the petitions for reconsideration, I'd rather have it clear that those aren't required to exhaust. Because as it is, we're always playing this guessing game of whether you need to or not. And I believe the Supreme Court's standard was you're required to exhaust any available administrative remedy. And if we can say that these are not necessary or somehow, you know, get past that by saying that exhaustion has occurred even if you haven't filed a petition for reconsideration or a 1701A3 hearing request, that would make it clear for the parties. And I agree with Chris that should be our goal, is clarity.
My concern is that the discretion afforded state agencies in Idaho is very limited. And I appreciate your faith and belief that, you know, if we say it, others will agree with us, but that just hasn't been my experience before courts. They'll go back to the statutes and interpret those. And, you know, maybe we now have a court that will view things very differently than, let's say, the Eisman or Jones courts were doing on statutory interpretation. But
you shared that screen right there.
I feel very... I do feel that it's not wise for the department to venture into these areas that are just unsettled at this point in time.
let the courts decide what it is, what it says, and how it gets settled, and then we'll work from there. Is my general recommendation to the client.
Hey Chris, can you see the exhaustion language up on the screen?
Yes.
So the language says you're not entitled to judicial review. They have to exhaust all administrative remedies required in this chapter. So that's what's required by statute, not by rule. We probably, if you want to really go after this, you'd probably have to see what essentially every other agency is saying about this, because it's a statutory requirement and not something that each agency can define by rule. There's essentially one interpretation of the statute, one correct one. The courts will decide that in the end, and the agency simply can't strike out on its own, especially if there's all sorts of other agencies saying, well, you do have to do this as required by the chapter. So you can see what sort of the dilemma we're in, that we can send people astray and the exhaustion requirements grow out of the chapter, not out of our rules. You're putting the agency in a little bit of a hard spot by asking us to do that. I think that's my take.
Go ahead, Chris, sorry.
I guess another approach, taking what you say, recognizing the value of what you say, maybe we ought to, go to the Attorney General's office or what have you and say, let's just change the APA. I mean, you could do a pretty quick fix to this, add a new subsection saying that, agencies have the authority to specify by rule which procedures are optional and which are mandatory in order to exhaust remedies.
This is Dylan Lawrence. I have a quick question. Apologies, I was late to this. But if that's the standard in that statute required in this chapter, I mean, is there anywhere in Chapter 52 that requires a petition for reconsideration? I don't understand why that's not the answer, because exhaustion only applies for things that are required in the chapter. And as I recall, there's nothing that ever in Chapter 52 itself that requires somebody to file a petition for reconsideration, unless I'm just misremembering.
Agreed.
Dylan, I'm going back and trying to recall the arguments that came before Judge Wildman. And I think the tension there was looking at the statute saying, well, hey, it says you must exhaust all administrative remedies. And Judge Wildman, if I recall correctly, said, well, we have this other statute that says that once it's become a final order, or once nobody challenged the order, it became a final order, and then thus that allowed you to bootstrap yourself into the right to be able to file a district court appeal. You might be able to do a similar analysis with regards to a petition for reconsideration. But again, I don't know if that's the accurate analysis here. I think it just comes back to, what does it mean that you must exhaust all administrative remedies? Does all mean all? We learned that it, at least in one context, it doesn't mean all, but could there be other contexts? And when you especially take that and look at the line of cases that talk about the importance of giving the decision maker the ability to fix mistakes. I guess on one hand, I can understand the desire to say, okay, we jump from a hearing officer and skip the director and go right to district court. But even if the hearing officer hasn't been given the opportunity to fix his mistakes in the first instance, is that truly exhaustion? I don't know where a court would come out on that kind of balancing. And so that's our concern. And I think going back to Mike Lawrence's comment, where essentially he said, well, by addressing that one, aren't you really addressing the other? And I can see that. I don't necessarily think that wins, but I can see that. And really, by addressing one, we were trying to do a compromise. We said, okay, I think there is case law supporting this position, and so we felt very comfortable, you know, putting that statement in there. But if parties feel that it, you know, us addressing the one, you know, makes the other unquestioned, we can just not address either of them and just leave it as is, as an option, if that's, you know, if there's sufficient concern there.
This is Sean Costello. I think at this point, I think we need to step back and look at 67, 52, 46, sub 4, and we just need to do some more due diligence, and I think we can maybe have a better answer or make a change to the proposed rule.
Thanks. That's all I have.
Do you want to see if John Murdoch is okay with that language regarding beds?
Yeah, why don't we flip all over to the screen. John Murdoch, did you have a chance to take a look at the proposed changes that you can just go stop sharing?
Yes, I'm sorry, I just stepped away. Related to the attorney representation requirements?
Yeah.
Where we're at now.
Did you feel comfortable with that?
Yes, I mean, it looked like a carve-out for federal and Indian parties, and, you know, one could say more, but I understand the desire to to keep this, do this with as few words as possible. So I appreciate you addressing that. And as long as that is intended as a, you know, a pathway in rather than a hurdle, I think we're fine with that.
Okay. Does anybody else on the call here today have any additional comments they want to make? TJ, your screen just kicked on. What do you got for us?
Yeah, I've just got one small one, and I apologize if this is something that you covered last time. I was not able to participate in the last call, and I also want to thank Chris and Mike for all the time they put into it. It's been helpful to walk through some of these, and they covered some of the questions I had. The one other item I had a question about is rules 152 through 155. Sean, I'm going to pull those up, but this is the section that lists all the different type of participants. There's petitioners, respondents, protestants, interveners. It sounds like there was maybe some discussion about simplifying that in the past, and the department declined to do that. I'm interested in the thinking there. I've always been a little confused why we have all these different designations and we don't just call people parties or not parties.
Sean's trying to share the screen now so everybody can see that.
Well, while he's doing that, we have in 150, we have a definition of parties that encompasses all these different types of parties, petitioners, respondents, protestants, interveners. And I guess I've never really appreciated the need to have these additional definitions and categories for people that are participating. You're either a party to the case or you're not, regardless of what you're called.
I guess I haven't thought specifically of do we really not need any of these, but historically we have used these in different particular actions and in different parts of the proceedings, and it helps trigger, you know, who does what at what particular point in time. You know, if there's somebody who files a petition, you know, identifying them as a petitioner, but then a respondent has a particular time frame for responding to that document, I think it helps identify who needs to do what at any one particular part and point in time. But you know, that's just as I sit here today, TJ, we can take additional thought and see if maybe, you know, we'll take this under additional advisement and see if we can maybe get rid of these, because I, you know, we are looking to try to streamline things, but we also don't want to streamline them so much that it makes things confusing for folks. So.
Yeah, thanks, Garrick. I'm just throwing that out as food for thought, and I'm not suggesting the department couldn't use these terms, you know, within a particular case. I'm just not sure we need to have specific rules to define them. I did kind of quickly look through the APA. It doesn't make these decisions. It does sometimes talk about respondents and things like that, but it generally categorizes people as parties or non-parties to the case. So I guess that's just put on your list of things to consider, and maybe we can cut those out or maybe not.
Excellent. Thank you.
This is Chris, just following up on what I thought was an excellent observation by TJ. It kind of fits into a suggestion that I had made earlier that I think the department didn't include, but maybe we ought to toss it out there again, which is just have a clear provision saying, again, in the spirit of what TJ said, you know, there are two types of entities, parties and non-party participants. And that if, for example, you withdraw your protest, but you still want to appear in some other role, you're appearing as a non-party, i.e. you cannot appeal. And that's something that, you know, I think most people understand, but maybe not all protestants do. And we do have, you know, some proceedings where people withdraw their protest, but they still want to play some sort of a role. In any event, I guess what I'm trying to get at is that, you know, there ought to be some clear distinction so people know what they are, and just saying, you know, okay, I'm one of these 16 labels. Well, are you in the group that can appeal or not?
Okay, Chris, thank you.
At the risk of monopolizing the discussion, I guess there's one other thing that I want to just ask for guidance on as to whether I should address this in the next round of comments or not, and that's the question of definition of contested case. I made a run at trying to provide some clarity on that, which the department declined, and so I guess my question is, should I try again or not? I can understand the particular approach I suggested didn't work for the department. I'm wondering if there's anything that we could do, or if the department would be interested in offering any clarity on what a contested case is. And you know, the reason why that could be helpful is that the term has now become a misnomer due to a Supreme Court decision, because a contested case is not necessarily contested, at least in the lay meaning of the term. And is there something that the rules could do to just explain that to the lay reader? Again, my goal in this is to allow people to understand the rules without having gone to law school or be an expert in administrative law. And seems to me maybe a sentence or two could explain that the term contested case doesn't mean that there's even a protest. Or do you want me to just throw in the towel on that?
Well, I'll never tell you to throw in the towel, Chris, but this is very similar to our earlier conversation about exhaustion. Here we do have a statutory definition, and going beyond that, I think as a group here, we've been very cautious to go beyond a clear statutory definition to add further gloss to that, especially in, as you've already identified, the case law surrounding what constitutes a contested case is not the clearest. And I think, as we've seen, even with this new court coming on board, there's additional gloss being put on what actually constitutes a contested case before an agency. As we saw with the Vickers decision here a couple of, maybe now 1 or 2 years back. So I think our hesitancy is that a safe place for us to be is here's the statutory definition. And to the extent, you know, somebody has a question in a proceeding, you know, the hearing officer can talk to the participants and say, well, you know, this is might be their understanding, and you can work through those issues, you know, before the hearing officer. And if somebody disagrees, they can make any whatever legal arguments they want to there. But I think our reluctance here is just to wade in to an area of law which, at least I view, is still not totally settled at this point in time.
Okay, thank you. That's appreciated. I will not beat that horse anymore. And let me also just conclude by saying, I really mean it. Thank you. I mean, this has been a really, really useful process. And I'll bet you I speak for everybody on this Zoom meeting and feeling that way. You're listening to us. That doesn't always happen. Thank you.
Yeah, well said, Chris. Thanks for your effort, Sean and Garrick and the others.
All right, TJ, did you have any other comments, TJ, or?
That's it for me.
Anybody else on the phone have any comments? Well, hearing none, Sean, well, we go back over what our timelines are again. Just the high level ones.
Sure.
Four additional comments, written comments.
Yeah, so 2 weeks from now, July 7th, if we can get written comments from you all or from anyone who's interested in providing them, that will give us about 3 weeks to prepare the proposed rule, which I think is manageable. Complicates things a bit because we'll have to get approval from the director and from the board within that time as well. So if you guys can do it in 2 weeks, that would be great. So July 7th. And at that point, you know, you won't see anything more from us until you see the notice of proposed rulemaking and the proposed text that accompanies that notice. So I think that's it. And then the other thing to be aware of, once it publishes on September 1st, that will trigger that next public comment period, which will run for 21 days and September 22nd.
And so there'll be an additional opportunity for folks to provide written comments to us based upon the rule as it was published.
The proposed rule as published, right. So you still have two more opportunities. You've got the 2 weeks to July 7th, and you'll have some time in September.
And just to clarify, Sean, let's also, you know, when we send over what we're going to have published over to DFM, you know, the July 30th, mm-hmm. Let's go ahead and send the participants in our discussions here, let's send that to them directly so they don't have to just hunt down the bulletin.
Okay. Well, I will say, I mean, we can send our proposed text and the proposed notice, but that's, you know, it takes a month for them to compile that into the bulletin, but if we don't have a lot of there's nothing that we can do to change it at
right.
this point. Just FYI.
I just wanted to make sure that they didn't have to go, you know, looking for the bulletin and find the bulletin. You know,
1722.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, I think that's all we have, unless anyone has anything else.
Can you send us via email a Word version of Straw Man 2?
Yes. I'll include these deadlines as well in that email. James, did you have anything else? Anyone in the room? Peter, Matt, Shelley?
No.
Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.